Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
Hip-hop has been saying Black Lives Matter for 40 years.
You. The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sataro. This is episode 137, a talk with Kevin Koval and Nate Marshall. Kevin and Nate, along with Quraysh Ali Lansana, are co-editors of the new poetry anthology, The Breakbeat Poets. The book is billed as being the first poetry anthology by and for the hip-hop generation, and features the work of 78 different poets, representing several different generations of hip-hop fans and practitioners. The book is a first step in creating a breakbeat poets movement, a way of bringing the poetics and aesthetics of hip-hop into the world of poetry. Kevin, who longtime Cypher listeners may remember from his appearance on episode 52 with Adam Mansbach, is the author of many books, including Shtick, Elvis Lives, Race Music Poems, Everyday People, and the American Library Association Book of the Year finalist, Slingshots, a Hip-Hop Poetica. He's the founder of Louder Than a Bomb, the Chicago Youth Poetry Festival, artistic director at Young Chicago Authors, and teaches at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Nate Marshall is the author of the NAACP Image Award-nominated book, Wild Hundreds. He's a founding member of the poetry collective Dark Noise and is also a rapper. We talked to Kevin and Nate at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. If you enjoy The Cypher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with another great poet who straddles the worlds of poetry and hip-hop, Saul Williams, on episode 17. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. While you're there, make sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter to keep track of everything that's going on with us. And now, here's the breakbeat poets themselves, Kevin Koval and Nate Marshall. We start in the middle of our conversation about how styles of pizza and gentrification prove that New York is better than Chicago.
People think they're very slick. They do that like in Chicago all the time. They're like, it's West Wicker Park.
It's a nigga, that's Humble Park.
I know, that's like, there's like 85 Puerto Ricans like in the street this second. What are you talking about? It's West Wicker Park, my dude. You know, like you're crazy.
Nice. Yeah, you know, it's when I was talking to Nate before you got here just about some of the differences between New York and Chicago in terms of gentrification. He was saying it happens a lot more quickly in New York, that it tends to be like people, regardless of race and kind of similar economic, you know, places will move into a neighborhood. Whereas in Chicago, it seems to be more kind of racially segregated.
Ain't nobody moving where black people live.
No, yeah. No, no. Until black people are gone.
Exactly.
And then they're like, oh my God, this area is amazing.
Right.
Look at so, all of
did
this
you know they
space.
Have lake over here?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's so much grass.
I love this park. I mean, that's the thing New York has over Chicago. You know, they have a few, there's a few things. No. And there's three things. There are three, maybe you might not agree. The
right.
First thing is the pizza in New York is preferable because I'll tell you why. I don't like cheese pie. I also think that New York, you can buy organic tomatoes at 3 a.m. and I appreciate that. And integration. You know, you guys do that a lot better than Chicago, you know.
But integration.
Yeah, no, it is overrated. I agree.
Overrated.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's true. That's true. Yeah, yeah. I'm more of a nationalist myself. Actually,
hey,
I'm not, but.
To be fair, Dr. King plagiarized a lot of his dissertation, so.
Listen. So it is racialized in that way, though. Like gentrification is. I mean, and part of what I think is that it's just a influx of like a reversal of white flight. I think that there has been this. I mean, this is a lot of what my next book is about gentrification in Chicago, particularly Wicker Park in the 90s, because how Wicker Park went, so went in some ways a lot of rest of the country. Like there were mayoral conferences looking at what Wicker Park specifically did right or wrong, depending on, you know, where you are on the socioeconomic ladder. And yeah, it's an influx of white people and whiteness. It's a little crazy.
Wow. Is this going to be a poetry book or nonfiction book? Or?
Yeah, book of poems. Okay. Yeah, I'm waiting on the title. But it's, I mean, it is like a history book because I'm going back to
you said
like.
You're waiting on the title?
I'm still, yeah, I don't have the title.
I thought you.
I know, but I think I need to broaden it and have it not just be Chicago. You think so? So
You told me one.
Yeah,
you told
I know.
Me
so these are the very. Either the People's History of Chicago, which I think is too narrow.
Yeah, I agree.
And then it was A Brief History on Gentrification. And then the third title was White on the Block, A Brief History of Gentrification. Because then I could also get into like the, you know, Reaganomics and the war on drugs, but
right.
But
we'll
you're
not see. Totally sold on any of the three,
unless we could agree on it today, gentlemen.
Well, we can.
All right. I agree. The third one is definitely in the lead.
Great.
Okay.
Nice. So we're here, you know, for the Breakbeat Poets anthology, and so Kevin, the you know, I guess it makes sense to start with the title. The whole idea was sparked by a conversation you had with Idris Goodwin.
Idris Goodwin is an award-winning playwright, rapper, and essayist, and has albums including Breakbeat Poems and Rhyming While Black. He's also been featured on HBO, Sesame Street, and the Discovery Channel.
He used that phrase just in a conversation. So when he used it, what happened? Did, like, time stop? Fireworks go off? Like, what happened when he said that?
Kind of did. I was like, right. I had to be like, you know how in battle rap, they'll be like, rewind, you know what I mean? They'll make them say that shit again.
Yeah.
And I really had to be like, my man, what did you just say? Like, what happened? By the way, on my way here, I was talking to Idris and he's like, yo, you need to shout me out. Cause he listens to the podcast a lot. He loves this podcast. He's just like, yo, you need to shout me out while I'm on the treadmill. I want to be motivated. Okay. So that you did it like from jump is good. It's a good look.
Nice. So what did that phrase kind of evoke for you when you first heard it?
I think that for a long time, and in part because I've been so influenced by the Black Arts Movement, I've been so influenced by the Beat Generation, the New Yorican School of Poetry, and I've always been interested in communities of artists in conversation with one another across genre, but because I'm a writer, you know, particularly writers, but also how writers are learning from the musicians of the era and the visual artists of that era and the philosophers of that moment. You know, I've always saw and needed and wanted to find my peers, my people. And so, you know, when I started to meet with Idris and when I started to meet with other folks and, you know, I mean, I've known Nate since Nate was 13 or 14 years old.
Yeah, man.
But even in that experience, I knew that me becoming an educator was also very much about finding my people. And so to me, when Idris said that, it felt like it was a unifying moment for both the aesthetics and the cultural moment and a assessment of who was practicing in the community. And it felt, you know, very right.
Yeah. And so how did you guys choose, you know, which works got in the anthology? Did people submit? Did you read like the entire output of every poet you knew? Like what happened?
I mean, I think, so we knew a lot of the poets in the book we know personally, have personal relationships with. And there were some of them, there were like poems from them that we were like, yeah, we need that. But a lot of people just submitted it. And there were some folks that we had never, that we didn't know personally, that we came across through sort of telling folks about the project and then getting submissions. And it was a lot of stuff. Like that, I mean, this book is 200 some odd pages. And so I'm sure we looked at like close to 1,000 pages worth of work.
There's 78 poets in the book. We did not do an open call. We kind of what we did is we relied on who we knew we wanted in the book, and then in some instances asked them to recommend folks that we might not know. And we ended up getting some really great poems.
And
that
people
way.
Passed it around. So there were like folks. That's how we came across a lot of the people we didn't know. Is that people would forward it to their homies and be like, "Yo, this is hot. Send some stuff."
And so there are three editors on the book. How did you guys all come together to do it?
Yeah, I mean, I initially, and this is probably, and Nate, you could tell me, I think maybe like we talked about it like 6 years ago at this point, maybe seven.
It was like 2009, probably like 2009, 2010.
Yeah. So I had written a book proposal for the University of Illinois Press, and this was before I was being published on Haymarket, and submitted it to them. Quraysh Ali Lonson, our co-editor, the third editor of the book, was a reader for the University of Illinois Press at the time. I think like I got a contract from them, but then my person at the press left. And all this is like really fortuitous in some ways. So I'm glad I mean, no shots at University of Illinois Press, but I'm much happier. One, in the moment that the book came out in, I think that was a bit of a tipping point in culture in some ways. And the book is having a ripple effect that I think if we published earlier, it might not have the traction perhaps that it did. But I really wanted to build with Nate in the book because, you know, even though, you know, Nate, I met when I was in my late 20s and he was a teenager. You know, since that time, I feel like the work that we are doing collectively in Chicago is very much about building this generational moment. And then I also I think we wanted to include someone who was a little older than us. And also Quraysh is not only one of the mentees of Haki Madhubuti, who is one of my mentors and, you know, the kind of one of the you know, main pillars of the Black arts movement in Chicago.
Haki Madhubuti is a poet and one of the architects of the Black arts movement. A publisher, editor, and educator, he has published more than 28 books of poetry and nonfiction. He is an award-winning poet and recipient of the National Endowment for the Arts and National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowships, the American Book Award, an Illinois Arts Council Award, the Studs Terkel Humanities Service Award, and others. Quraysh Ali Lonson, the third editor of the book along with Kevin and Nate, is also a poet, editor, and educator. Lonson has been a literary teaching artist and curriculum developer for over a decade and has led workshops in prisons, public schools, and universities in over 30 states. He is a former faculty member at Juilliard and served as director of the Gwendolyn Brooks Center for Black Literature and Creative Writing at Chicago State University from 2002 to 2011. He's currently on faculty at the Art Institute in Chicago and Oklahoma City University. Lonson and Madhubuti have worked together in various capacities since Lonson sought out Madhubuti at the Third World Press bookstore.
But Quraysh was also a student of Gwendolyn Brooks, and I think that we see this work very much in that tradition. And in a lot of ways, if it wasn't for Gwendolyn Brooks, I don't even know if there'd be hip-hop.
Gwendolyn Brooks was a highly regarded, much-honored poet with the distinction of being the first Black author to win the Pulitzer Prize. She was also poetry consultant to the Library of Congress, the first Black woman to hold that position, and poet laureate of the state of Illinois. Many of Brooks's works display a political consciousness, especially those from the 1960s and later, with several of her poems reflecting the civil rights activism of that period. According to the Dictionary of Literary Biography contributor Georgie Ken, her body of work gave her a unique position in American letters. Not only has she combined a strong commitment to racial identity and equality with a mastery of poetic techniques, but she has also managed to bridge the gap between the academic poets of her generation in the 1940s and the young Black militant writers of the 1960s.
So to have that lineage for us, I think, was also essential.
You mentioned, you know, the timeliness of the book and how that sort of worked out in your favor. I think, you know, reading it, I think that's very true. There is something about it, you know, despite the fact that it's been in the works for 5 or 6 years, it is in some ways very, very much of this particular moment in addressing stuff that's going on right now.
Yeah. And I mean, I think in a lot of ways we were kind of talking about this before. I think that, you know, many of the questions that the poems and that hip hop really wrestles with are contemporary questions that have been sort of in the public consciousness for the better part of the, you know, last few decades, right? Last 4 or 5 decades. So, you know, when we talk about like who has a right to the city, who has, you know, how drugs are moving through communities and how the legal response to drugs is moving through communities, like those are the questions that the poems take up, and they're the questions of the genre, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, hip hop has been saying Black Lives Matter for 40 years, and this is the book, I think, is in part, especially when we see it being used as a textbook in high schools or colleges around the country, I think it is also serving as a mirror in an anthology in, you know, traditionally, you know, Euro-centered settings that young people are finding themselves in. And I think that that's really a powerful thing at any moment, but there is something about, given the, you know, the constant dehumanization in the public sphere of bodies of color, for people around the country to see themselves in something that they rock with.
And, you know, most importantly, you know, something I think basically everyone wants to know, what was the biggest fight the three of you got in while you were putting the book together?
I wonder. There are some people in the book, I think, that And I'm not going to name names.
Yeah, we can't name names. Come on, man.
But I wonder. I mean,
you can use initials or sounds like
right. He's trying to
going back to back.
Beefs,
yeah, I know. I think that I wonder. I think that's also why we had three editors in some ways. And I think that even though we come from similar places and in some ways similar schools, I think our tastes are also different. Yeah. And so I think that we made the case for some people or Nate made the case for some people that I was like, yo, I don't know if I really rock with them or I might actually not be smart enough to understand what they're doing. And he's like, nah, this is dope, and reread it. And I went back and in some instances was like, okay.
And there were definitely things that you were like, no, we need this. And I was like, I don't give a fuck about that.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah. And later on, I kind of came around.
Right.
Yeah. I think ultimately it made a better book. There are, I mean, I think that we knew. So, you know, and I talk about this a little in the intro, like when I first read Willie Perdomo, when I first read, you know, Paul Beatty, who's not in the book, Sekou Sundiata, who, you know, rest in power. I mean, these are folks that when I read them on the page, for the first time, I felt like this is what the poetic of hip hop looked like translated to the poem. And there are some people in the book who very specifically we knew like what poems exactly, you know, and either they weren't published and we just heard them because we did readings with them, or mm-hmm. like in the instance of Willie specifically, he was gracious enough to just be like, yeah, just publish what you want.
Yeah.
And I was like, word, okay, let's do that, you know.
Right, let's publish his whole book.
Yeah.
The first half of the anthology will just be Willie's catalog, and then we'll get to everything. Yeah.
And so, Nate, you said hip-hop has changed. You said how to approach art and how to approach the world.
Yeah.
And the anthology is a reflection of that. To the extent that that can kind of be put into words, how did hip-hop do that? What kind of changes, like, are you talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so One of the things that hip hop does, and we have to think about like that new Kanye, or the Kanye song that is nominated for the Grammy All Day, that has like 50, like your mom's is like
yeah,
a co-writer.
She got
a
writing.
She got credit.
Congrats,
yeah.
By the way.
Kanye West's 2015 track All Day, nominated for Best Rap Song at the upcoming February 2016 Grammys, has a total of 19 credited songwriters, including Paul McCartney, Chicago's own Vic Mensa, Kendrick Lamar, and our episode 84 guest, producer 88 Keys.
Yeah. Everyone's nominated for a Grammy for that song, right?
And we're very excited.
Right? And one of the reasons why is because Kanye's pulling from all of these things, right? He doesn't give a fuck. He'll pull from an old Paul McCartney or like Beatles joint, and he'll be like, yo, Vic Mensa, like, do something for me. And The Dream, just sing, like, a melody for 20 seconds, right? He'll pull from any place musically to make the freshest thing. And I think that in a lot of ways, like, that is the poetic or the literary tradition that we're thinking in, right? We're not worried about, oh, this is the canon, this is great literature, this is great art. We're like, yo, is this fresh? Or even if it's not fresh, like, what can I steal from this? What can I take from this to make something hot?
What part of it might be fresh,
right?
You know? And I think that that's how we are really pulling from, you know, the ingenuity of Afrika Bambaataa and other folks. I mean, anyone who uses sample-based culture. And, like, in that regard, like, Ye is very much a contemporary artist, you know, where he is not concerned with the myth of origination, but is certainly, like, open to just collective thought being out there. And then, you know, I mean, his name is on stuff, but also you see in that Grammy nod, it's like,
right,
he's also giving, you know, due respect.
Right. And it's such a different and more interesting way to... It's a more challenging way to engage art, right? Because what's real easy to like look at something and be like, yo, this is whack. What is much more difficult and much more nuanced is to say, I think this is whack, but what about it is compelling?
Right. It reminds me of, you know, Joe Schloss, who's one of our past guests, wrote a book about, you know, sampling and sort of the unofficial rules producers had. And this might not be the case anymore, but for a while, one of their sort of big rules was you can't sample anything that's too good on its own. Or too famous on its own.
In his book, Making Beats, The Art of Sample-Based Hip-Hop, Schloss defines this rule as, one can't sample records one respects. He says, this rule rests on three pillars. That sampling may be disrespectful to a great artist, that some music is so good that sampling does not improve it, and that sampling something that was already good is not sufficiently challenging.
Yeah. And shout out to Joe. Joe is a dope theorist. I think that's real. I think obviously Puff broke that rule.
and Will Smith.
And tons of others. And, right. And you know, but in some ways, I think that's also, you know, the beauty and genius of, you know, a sample-based culture is the digging, is being also at one time an archaeologist, to really get. And that's what we do in literature. I mean, Google is the writer's best friend in some ways in this moment, as well as the library. But to be able to dig through all these volumes or thoughts or words, I mean, etymology all day is a way to play with language. And we're in such an exciting moment. You know, like one of the ways that this manifests, too, is like right now, you know, Chance is on Saturday Night Live. He brought 20 people with him to do that gig. Then I rapped on this show. Simple as that. Got the complex from complex off with the simplest raps. And it goes, feeling a fire. Chances up high. You cannot believe it. I'm a rider. Riding on 20s. 20 is higher. I couldn't buy it. If you look at even his, the social experiment.
Some weak characters.
It's incredible, you know. And so I like that. And I think that's why we also consider ourselves the breakbeat poets, and that it's a moniker that people in the book are using. Like, I am a breakbeat poet. And even folks that we have in classes are also like, yo, I'm a breakbeat poet. And I think, like, we see, you know, multiple volumes of this and multiple generations of this. Yeah. And it is that notion that we are a crew, large, extended, like, you know, there'll be like 88 members of the Woo, and right. We'll probably be like, you know, 1,500 breakbeat poets, you know?
You know, and the one thing that I think is so ill about hip hop too is that it is such a sample-based culture, and that's not just in the sonics, but it's also in the writing, right? So, like, the other day, I was in class, and I was teaching this Pharoah Monch, the song Clap, right? No respect, no manners, it's Mad Max, multiple mats, mad banana clips, a black hammer that hits the back of a black talent, a slew of hollow tips through the wall of your blue salads.
What class is this, and when can I take it?
You got to go to Indiana.
Right, you got to go to Indiana, so yeah, it's going to be a minute. But I teach at Wabash College. So this is like an intermediate poetry workshop. But I don't care. So,
or you do care share like one of the illest.
Right. But when you look at that, right, when you look at the song and the visual and the sonics, right, they're samples. You see Nina Simone sort of checked in certain ways. You see like Macbeth checked in certain ways. Like this is multi-layered music, right? A multi-layered culture, right?
That gets to something that I wanted to ask about the anthology is like, there are, you know, a bunch of themes kind of running through it. You guys talk about stuff about, you know, sampling culture and interpolation and, you know, obviously stuff about politics and the police and drugs and communities and things like that. Was that stuff you were thinking about when putting the book together? Like, how conscious were you of like, oh, we want certain themes to run through the book? Or was that kind of more organic?
I think it was organic. I think that we were looking for probably first and foremost, just the most quality poem.
Yeah.
You know, really believe in kind of the, you know, integrity of the craft. And a lot of the folks in the book are for real, very serious about their pen game. So we were looking there first. I think that one thing that I really love about the book is it's also a lot of celebratory moments. That part, you know, from Jump Street in the culture is also the notion that in the face of deindustrialization and, you know, the rising prison industrial complex, young people are also going to find a way to party, to have, you know, a park jam or to, you know, turn up. And so I see a lot of that in the book. And I don't know if prior to us putting it together, I was necessarily thinking like that. But then to see what beautiful odes and portraits people paint of neighborhoods that they love or spaces that they, you know, were fond of as adolescents and came up in, you know, those I think are some of my favorite pieces in the book.
Yeah. And Nate, in an interview once, you were talking about hip hop being, you called it hyper local and hyper contemporary.
Yeah.
And that really jumped out at me. I was hoping you'd explore that a little bit. Like, what is so specifically hip hop about the need to like be rooted in your time and place?
I mean, I think in a lot of ways it's from hip hop's genesis as a performance form, as a live form, right? So, you know, when you're like first at that first moment of like people beginning to create rhymes, you're not you're not trying to like be the most famous cat in the world or to write like it's not a pop song in the sense that like you want to write something that is broad and sort of expansive and global. You're like, I'm like, we're on Flatbush right now. Right.
Like right now, like 1991. Like, right. Like I'm going to name check the year.
Right.
Fresh for 88. You suckers. Cause 88. Time to set it straight. You know what I'm saying?
89. The number. Another song.
1990 motherfucking one.
1993 exoticness.
9-9, nigga. Guess who's back?
But the 9-9 in the 2000s.
Just the year 2000.
2005, you ain't seen nothing yet.
2012, clutch as fuck. I'm the biggest hypocrite in 2015.
Right. 1991, like, John Starks just scored 2 points. What? Like, it's that specific. It's that specific, and there's some real power to that, right? Like, you know, so whenever you see sort of hip-hop stories told, right, you see the moment at which people... which language expands because of that, like, focus on the local, right? So when, what is it, in the movie Straight Outta Compton, when they're like, what the fuck is a 6'4"? You know, what is a Gap?
What the fuck is yanking? And what's a 6'4"?
Yeah.
It's a car. A 6'4 Impala.
Yanking is...
And that expands the culture, right? Or in the movie Creed, right? The new joint. Shout out to Ryan Coogler. That's the homie. But in the movie Creed, like when they have the thing about like, well, what's a John? And that kind of gets broken down, right?
Yeah. Where are you?
I'm there.
So are you back there? John this, John that. What's a John?
It's a noun.
Okay.
It's like a, see, these is Johns. This is a John. Wow. This restaurant was sitting in, it's a John. You're a John.
You got a John? Like a dude?
No. I got so much going on right now.
Shows and stuff.
Yeah, and I think that is also, for us, I would probably say that's what makes for a good poetic. And,
yeah.
And part of the reason why pop songs don't, for me, necessarily always do the work of being a poem is because it is not rooted in the specific. You know, to put down the particular is really a way to articulate the universal. And I think that's part of the reason why we rock, you know, in this genre and why it speaks intimately to not only the person experience who you're listening to, but is then an immediate way to reflect on your own experience. Willie talks a lot about his poems are about articulating what's happening at 110th and Lex very specifically. You know, he spent a life on that corner and looks out into the intersection and will tell you what's happening. In that same way, you know, you see various, you know, I mean, even what's interesting is even Drake now, who arguably maybe I would say started more as a pop musician and now is filtering his way back into a particular poetic, and more so over the last few songs and albums is putting on for the six.
Running through the six with my walls.
I mean, we, you know, prior to that moment, maybe you knew Drake came from Toronto, but now he's very much more rooted in those notions of hyper locale.
Right. I mean, like, I love, what is it, in the Worst Behavior video when he's just like running through like basically like his cousin's neighborhoods in Memphis and shit. Cause I mean, I went to school in Tennessee, so I'm like, oh, damn, like, I've seen those cats flip like on Beale Street. Like, I've been in that moment, right?
Yeah.
And there's a real power in that connection. Like, my first book of poems is called Wild Hundreds, and that's the name of the part of the city that I'm from. And the first time I ever heard that phrase wasn't a rap song. It was D.A. Smart, Walk With Me, right? And he said, let's take a trip to the wild, wild hundreds. Roseland is a living hell. Bodies dropping all gale from Tintray to Riverdale.
You can go to Coach Club and Calumet with me. Close proximity, but that's not considered the city.
I was born in Roseland. When I was born, we lived in Riverdale. My dad went to high school in Augale. So I was like, oh, I get it. Like, this is, you know, like, that. There's no more powerful moment for a young person, right?
Yeah. And so one thing that happens in the anthology is you guys actually wrote a manifesto for the Breakbeat Poets. Was that kind of nerve-wracking to be like, I am now saying, like, did you view it as like, I am saying forever what this movement is going to be? Pretty bold thing to write a manifesto for a movement.
Yeah. I think it's, in some ways it's bold, but I also think that, like, you know, what Zora Neale Hurston has a dope quote about, you have to speak about your pain or else they'll kill you and say you enjoyed it. I might be fucking it up a little bit. But that idea, right? So it's going to be messy. It's going to be inaccurate. There's going to be ways in which we can be corrected. But it's important that we speak and document the knowledge production that's happening in our moment, or else other people will. And they'll get it way wronger. I also just thought it was fucking cool.
I imagine we'll be in the process of revising it for, you know, also the next 40 years, you know, yeah. and opening it and finding yeah. ways to, you know, broaden the scope. I mean, even the next anthology in the series that we're talking about, not edited by Nate and I, mind you, will be an anthology completely composed by prose and poems and maybe art as well from all Black women, multi-generational, but you know, that'll be like the next in that series, and then after that we are talking about an international look at how the poetic has influenced, you know, language around the world. But you know, even that will ultimately change what it is you know, we've done to this point and what it is we've conceived to this point, because it'll be a broader and more heads in the space, like more, you know, more people contributing to the cipher, and it's going to be iller that way, you know?
And the way you organize the book is cool. Like, you have it's organized by birth year of the poet, mm-hmm. from oldest to youngest. Well, first off, before we get into the particulars of it, why do that?
You know, I wanted to honor a little bit Donald Allen's anthology, New American Poetry, which is one of the anthologies that the book is inspired by. That came out in the 50s. It was one of the first places that Frank O'Hara and, you know, at the time, Leroy Jones and other folks were published. And that's how Donald arranged it. I want to say, and I'm not 100% sure, but also, I mean, there are two other anthologies that really were, the book was inspired by, Dudley Randall's The Black Poets and Amiri Baraka and Larry Neal's Black Fire. And in The Black Poets, I think it's also chronological
too. Yeah.
And so, you know, wanted to, you know, I mean, hip hop's 40 years old, and we have, you know, we go 61 and 99, basically four generations of practitioners who have been influenced by different moments in the culture. But I think for me, and I would, you know, I wonder, I think for you too, like, there is something that also is really uniting, you know, these writers, even four generations apart.
Yeah. Did you notice anything about the ages of the poets, like any kind of differences? Was there any sort of dividing line? I ask this because I feel like, in terms of music, there is a difference between people who sort of remember a world before hip hop and people who don't. And I was wondering if maybe something like that was reflected in the poem.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, and I don't know if this is necessarily in the poems, although, you know, I feel like there is a difference between folks who were writing prior to Pac and Big being killed and after. And I wonder if it's just like a shift in the culture itself.
Yeah.
In part because I think that what happened in that period from, you know, probably like Dre's The Chronic to the death of Biggie is that it really cemented hip hop's foray into the transition between counter and sub to popular culture. And that era then afterwards, it really is where hip hop is so prevalent that you can trip, you could throw a stone at a strip mall and yeah. hit a rapper probably.
Yeah.
But in the era prior to that, it was a culture that you really had to go access, leave your home to participate in order to even, you know, say anything, to write anything. You probably need to be physically enmeshed in some cultural space. And now it's just a little different. And it's there's no judgment value, and there's certainly no judgment value on the poems themselves. But that's an idea. I don't know if that's idea.
One of the things that's interesting for me is how references sort of come back, you know, which I think is like indicative of the culture, right? So like, you know, like, so some of the youngest people in the book are name checking like things and artists, like take Biggie, for example, right? Some of the youngest poets in the book are name checking him. And then you see the poets that are like maybe like 10 to 15 years older. So like about my age, and they're name checking Biggie. And then the folks that are older that then remember the moment really vividly remember that moment of like his like murder and all that, and their name checking him, and it means a different thing. But I mean, but that is some hip hop shit. Yeah.
You know, it's funny you mentioned hip hop being mainstream. You have that Tony Medina poem in the book with a super long title.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything you wanted to know about hip hop, but were afraid to be hipped for fear of being hopped. Hip hop halitosis. Hip hop, how you doing? Hip hop hosiery. Hip hop haberdashery. Hip hop hollandaise sauce. Hip hop Allopurinol inhaler. Hip hop hysterectomy. Hip hop Viagra. Hip hop Lamborghini. Hip hop chancletas. Hip hop unemployment. Hip hop fortune cookie. Hip hop auction block. Hip hop umbrella. Hip hop rocking chair. Hip hop chandelier. Hip hop hula hoop. Hip hop hooray. Hip hop hurricane.
To hear Tony Medina finish reading his poem, stay tuned after the credits.
For each of you, what's the most ridiculous, like, hip hop thing X that you've ever encountered?
Damn. Oh, like the, there's like the video online that's like the, it's like a country hip hop aerobic video or something.
Welcome to country hip hop, the newest trend in country line dancing. We've seen this hip hop dancing all over the United States and Canada as we've been touring. Two steps, running man, twist, running man, twist, scissors, jump, pigeon.
That shit is fucking ridiculous. There is also another like online sort of viral video that was a, I think it's like a hip hop dance video, and a very young Vin Diesel is one of the backup dancers.
Right.
And that is,
kick out the right and cross the left. Remove the left leg and replace further left.
I mean that's just beautiful. That's like my favorite thing. That's what I watch every morning before I brush my teeth.
I want to give like all sorts of hilarious answers because there are ridiculous, you know, like candy grills that I think I've seen kids wear at Halloween or some shit. But like really though, like the most ridiculous moment in hip hop is when, you know, Iggy Azalea exists and Macklemore wins the Grammy. Like that is,
yo,
that,
wait,
that's like, to
yo,
me,
shots at Macklemore.
That is a ridiculous moment in the culture. You know, that is the most mainstream that the culture could possibly do. That to give that award to that record in that moment, when also, you know, Kendrick is up and there's a bunch of other and also there's a billion other records that are out that are, you know, iller than Macklemore's. No shots.
Yo, let it be known, I have no beef with any of these cats, and I'll ghostwrite for Iggy Azalea in a second.
Hey, she's going to need it. that's not even saying that. I mean, Iggy Azalea is not, you know, and Erica was right. Like, she, you know, she made a good assessment that what she's doing is not necessarily rap.
Yes. Who is this? Iggy Azalea. Yeah, hey. Oh, no. You can come, because what you're doing is definitely not rap. Yeah.
You know, and I'm not like a culture keeper and I have no interest in it, but I think that at a popular, like mainstream level, those are moments that, you know, and it's just like when Rolling Stone called Eminem the king of rap, you know, that we live in these moments of, you know, these ahistorical realities that it's like, really, white people, like we're just going to do the same shit again and again forever. Like, yep. Okay. And yep. The answer is yes. Yeah.
Yeah, right. No surprise. In the we were talking about Biggie a second ago in the intro of the book, and I don't remember which one of you guys wrote it about Party and Bullshit.
That was me.
That was you.
Yeah. In the essay.
Yeah. The essay. Yeah. You wrote about Party and Bullshit and about how like his use of Abby Odun's sample is like more sophisticated than it might first appear.
Yeah.
That it's not just like, oh, he's taking a revolutionary work and using it in a song about partying.
Right.
When the revolution comes, when the revolution comes,
when the revolution comes.
But until then, you know and I know niggas will party and bullshit and party and bullshit and party.
Coming out just me and my crew, cause all we wanna do is
bullshit and we party.
I thought that was so interesting because when we had Dune on, he is still angry about it.
You know, folks can get away with saying party and bullshit at a chant and not see the significance of it as it was meant to be. It bothers me when I see that.
Yeah, and I mean, and I understand it. Like, it obviously makes sense, right? But in a lot of ways. So I also got to, like, name check my guy Aaron Samuels, because we talked a lot about this sort of as we were thinking through it, right? But, yeah, I mean, when you look at that song, like, it is specifically concerned with, like, the brevity of Black life, you know, and Biggie is articulating a kind of tenderness, a kind of care that in a lot of spaces would not be acceptable. Like, he tells his homeboy, he's like, whatever you need, love, I got you. Right? Like, he calls his man's love. And he's like, what he's saying is, like, I'll lay down my life to defend yours. So, yeah, we can just take that as, like, a party scene and, like, some young niggas being reckless and being like, yo, yeah, we're going to shoot up the party if shit gets live. But I also think that I think that is maybe not the most complex, maybe not the most accurate reading of that, right?
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things in the book, again, going with the Biggie theme for a second, you had Aziza Barnes doing these erasures.
Yeah.
Which is something that I don't feel like I maybe had seen, but certainly, yeah, it was a form I was not familiar with. Like, can you talk about what erasures are and, like, what she did with them?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, erasures are essentially a kind of poem or a kind of, like, cultural production where you take found text and then you begin to pull things away, right? So you make a poem and you'll, like, say you'll take, like, a Biggie song and say, I'm only going to use 20 words from this song.
Right. She did it with Juicy in the anthology.
Juicy, an erasure. Intro, all grip, yeah, all me. Nothing lived above. Buildings called on me. Feed my all, verse one, all. I used my every attack, my red match. Remember, you never take now, 'cause sin I used to call. If you don't chorus hold, I'll give you verse two change all day. Keep me, miss me, play me close like life without ears. I dropped all, verse three. Dead Money handles one room, on her back, of course. My face, no heat. Why we thirst? All. Don't you know the house mad?
Right, and I think that it's a really, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's kind of like sampling. Like, I mean, it's sort of what, it's like what Preem does, right? Where he'll, where, like, to build a hook, he'll just pull out like this phrase or this word from this thing and kind of reconstruct it, right? We've got it. You can feel the realness in this business of rap. Go ahead. Yeah, but I mean, I think the erasure form is super interesting, and the one of the cool things about it is that you have this new poem, right? And you could actually have that poem and not call it an erasure and not name it, and people would accept it as a poem. But by naming it an erasure and by doing that, that echo remains there, right? So you're reading this and it has whatever meaning it has, but you're still hearing Juicy. Like, Juicy doesn't get divorced from that space, which is kind of, I mean, that's like the genius of of the Sugar Hill Gang. That song is dope, and, like, I also like Chic, so, like, it works.
Yeah.
It's a kind of found poem. I also think that there's something about even the titling of the form of erasure, which is also to counter the erasure of people of color's history from the dominant narrative. And so I think that there is an insistence that, you know, folks will also be heard from and seen. And so I think that there's also, like, a, you know, a nice flip in that regard with a, you know, the traditional found poem.
So it seems like, you know, in some ways this book only could have come out of Chicago because of the overlap between the sort of community hip hop scene and the community poetry scene, that there's fewer divisions between that than in lots of other places. For people who aren't familiar with that, can you kind of lay out maybe how that came to be?
I think it's been like that for a long time. There was not a ton of space in Chicago for arts in general. Chicago is not a city that understands arts or culture makers. When you tell people you're an artist in Chicago, they ask you or they tell you that they like their cheeseburger medium rare, you know, because they don't think that it's an actual occupation. And so the space then for the creative arts is small. That being so, in the 90s, you know, there was this emergence of Chicago's indigenous hip hop scene where I think people in Chicago began to figure out and insert, you know, indigenous slang and story narrative into the cultural form. Prior to that, it was, you know, really kind of mimicking the export from New York. And in the 90s, and, you know, you look at, you know, groups like Crucial Conflict, or Nate said, you know, D.A. Smart, Common's first record. To a state ever tricky late, yo, I had to elevate. You can tell it's great because I'm straight off 87, the south side of Chicago. 501 can follow me, yo, everywhere that I go. There's this moment in that era where Chicago is really starting to figure it out. It also is emergent with a, spoken word hip hop poetry scene that has these antecedents from the Black Arts Movement. Quraysh is on in a crew called the Funky Wordsmiths in this moment. And I remember being younger and sneaking into places and seeing him up on stage in places like Spices. And there was a vibrant Lit-X. Southside poetry scene. And also then this space in Wicker Park called Lit-X, which was this convergence of song and lyric. There was the Africa West bookstore where Lupe's mom would bring him to spit at the open mic. Common was still around the scene at the time before he moved to Brooklyn. It was just the proximity of you know, poet and rapper, often in the same space. There was a Monday night open mic at a bar in Wicker Park called the Mad Bar on Damon Ave, where they did an open mic from like 7 to 9, and then hip-hop cypher open mic concert at 10. And so that overlap was literal. And I think that's part of the reason why the lyric and poetic in Chicago very much have to do with that, you know, interplay.
And I think, you know, for a lot of us, right, like if you were a young dude in Chicago and you wanted to rhyme, like you went to open mics and you just did your rhymes a cappella and they were poems, because that was just the place where mics existed. That was the place where you could get on a stage, right? So, so I remember like being young and wanting to rap and doing that very thing. The first time I ever saw a cypher. And part of this is again because of like the way that Chicago is sort of segregated and just built socially, like you don't necessarily go into communities that aren't yours. Like you don't really roam around spots that aren't yours unless you're there for some business, right? First time I ever saw a cypher was at Louder Than a Bomb Youth Poetry Slam, right? First time I ever like kicked rhymes was at open mics. I met Chance the Rapper at an open mic his freshman year, and he was like trying out for the slam team and like annoying the shit out of my homeboy and like, yo, let me get on the mic. And we're like, the fuck is this dude?
Unsuccessfully trying out for the slam
right,
team.
Right, right.
Never made the team.
Yeah.
The Jones College prep team.
Yeah, my man's Sean Peace is like, he's like, man, I should have probably let Chance on the team. But hey.
Amazing. That actually leads into something else, which is that kind of whole new generation of, you know, hip hop artists who kind of came up through that scene, even sometimes literally through workshops taught by the two of you, people like Chance and Vic Mensa and No Name Gypsy. When you sort of ran across them when they were teenagers, were those people some people who jumped out at you as like, oh, these people are super talented?
So I'm not that much older than a lot of those cats. So when I was a senior in high school, Chance and Vic were freshmen. Vic was a freshman at my high school, and he was on the soccer team. He was like the squirrely little mixed kid on the soccer team, and people like brought him to me and were like, yo, he raps. You should, like, I don't know, he just raps, so here, take him. And I like, you know, took him to the studio in the school and like set him down to record, and then would start to take him to open mics with me. And I think, you know, he was definitely someone who stood out just as like a very talented MC.
I'm from the city where they all illegal. In Hayterville, Illinois, where folks don't get along with people, you feel me? When niggas keep it too long and run up on you like you was chewing your stride too long. Selling on the same block that the school on. That's what kids me and only serve white like Tynas in the 60s. I'm only 16, spitting like I'm 19 and marketing all over the scene like Sprite cream.
He was just sharp. He was just a sharp kid. I think Chano in a different way was like not as... He was weird. Like, his voice was weird. I mean, and you still see this. Like, his voice was strange, and I think he didn't really know what to do with himself and with what he was working with.
I got suspended. Ooh, you got suspended for chief and 100 blunts, 14-400 minutes. Fans all in the stands, they hands for Mr. Bennett. That racket over the net. Ooh, give me my tennis shoes, give me a...
But he was so diligent. He was like... Like, he was there at everything all the time, constantly. And then, and No Name, I think, stood out just because she was, like, weird.
Let it be a bygone, how you python. Mama said never dance with snakes with the lights on.
And I think part of what is that they, I think when we met them, and I remember, you know, very early on, Nate championed Vic, and I knew Vic through Nate, but also like as a graffiti writer, he was running with folks and getting in trouble with folks who were much older than him that I knew. And they were also telling me about this kid who went to Whitney who rhymed. And I think when we met them, it was in some ways like the recognition that this breakbeat poet generation is real and also extends beyond, you know, like I think Nate and I are of a different generation, and maybe that they are also maybe of a different generation, maybe.
Yeah.
And that it was all crew. It was all family. And it felt that way. I think when No Name started to rhyme, she did Louder Than a Bomb, and I remember her senior year, like right after the festival, she was like, I want to be a rapper. And for a whole year, I think she dedicated herself to freestyling. Yeah. And
that's in my experience, that's all those Save Money people do all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Freestyle. Yeah.
But to all niggas trying to enter a cypher, man, spitting something that they wrote down.
I got niggas from every night.
Premeditated. You need to hesitate it before you even resuscitate it. You know what I'm saying? Because we don't fuck with that shit. You get stuck with that shit. Yo, it's GLC. And then I'm going to put the mic down. We're going to get to rapping.
Yo. Put the mic down. I say, he put the mic down. My nigga right there, he say he put the mic down. I say I'm a king, never put the crown down. Chilling at the temple crown, need to bow down.
I'm at the bow wow.
Yeah, and just their ability to do, and I think you see this in our poetic, and I think it comes from a shared love of language, of just putting words together that, you know, don't make sense necessarily, and incorporating slant rhyme and, you know, enjambment and certain kinds of musical phrasing that, you know, the Sonics really delight the ear. They're tuned into not only the musicality of the language, but because they're Chicago writers, they focus on this really slick, important narrative work that has very much to do with creating, you know, visuals of the working body. And so I think, like, you know, you stay seeing them do that.
I gotta tell the like Vic, like how he started rhyming story, because it's sort of incredible.
Yeah.
When he was, so he can't, like, folks brought him to me and he was like, yo, I wanna make a mixtape, because my homeboy, he said, I was out writing graffiti with me and my guy. The police came after us and I got away. My homeboy got popped. So I want to make a mixtape and sell it to like raise lawyer fees. And I was like, nigga, it's 2007. So like, you can't do that. but just come rock with me.
But let's work.
Right. I was like, this is the most hip hop story I've ever heard. like that's why you're going to start rapping.
That's amazing. Nice. And you know, Vic seems like a good fulcrum point to talk about something maybe a little more contentious, which is the movie Chirac, which he is in briefly, along with Young Chop in a concert scene.
Shortly after this interview was recorded, Vic Mensa took to Twitter to disavow his appearance in Chirac. His tweets read, in part, "Chirac the movie feels like a minstrel show. This movie is a mockery of the very real, very unsatirical violence in Chicago. And I'm in the Chirac movie. It was some dumb shit I got spun into and fought Spike about leaving. I told him to keep the check.
I saw it at the premiere. So rather than me kind of bias it, what did have you guys seen it? Will
so
you see it?
He's seen it. I might bootleg it, but I might see it. I might not see it. I can't call it.
I mean, I had to see it, you know, because I wanted to fully participate in the conversation. I think, like all of Chicago, was wary from the idea of it, for that it would be named as such. And then also, of course, once the trailers came out, there was, you know, a bit of a shitstorm back. And I still was trying to reserve judgment because I am historically a fan of Spike Lee's films, although he's made recently, like, really poor
films. I mean, historically I am, but the last decade?
Maybe not so much.
No.
But I saw it. I mean, my film review on Twitter was Chirac the movie is a bad spoken word musical about Spike Lee's hatred of women. And I think that's pretty accurate. I feel like that is what the movie is primarily about, although it's also about a gross negligence of victim blaming and not really doing enough work, extrapolating the legacy and maintenance of white supremacy, the rise of the prison industrial complex. And ultimately, like when he, and this is a spoiler alert, so I'm going to ruin the movie for folks who,
good,
you know, want to see it.
Yeah.
You can't ruin
but
it.
I will say,
no,
it's already ruined because it's a shitty film, is that, you know, the end is, Nick Cannon is in handcuffs talking about how free he is.
Sleepless nights, too weak to fight, couldn't reach us to teach us right. I cry in mothers, I die in brothers. D&D, that's what they want us to be, deaf and dumb. But you see, the only ones we protecting is the gun. So run, nigga, run. Let it run out of me. Cause I'm finally free from all these demons. Finally they leaving. Finally I'm breathing. So bring the truth. Bring the truth. Bring the truth, brother, bring.
And I think to do that in a moment where you constantly have this, you know, dehumanized black body, and then to have that image is just like reckless. And Spike Lee, you are so old and out of touch, my dude. And also, like, Chirac Beret's not the look. Like, sorry, dude. Like, move the fuck on. Get the fuck out my city. You know what I mean?
Is he the, I think he's the Kobe Bryant of this movie shit.
Didn't know when to move on.
Oh yeah, he's the Kobe Bryant of this film shit. He's like, he was great, but he ain't got no knees. he can't do this no more. He needs to stop.
Nice. So you may see it at some point. It's not like a principle that I will never.
Yeah, I mean, I probably will see it, but it's like from all indications, nothing about it makes it a cultural product that I need to be excited to consume or like move around my skin.
Now, I will say we are working on a book with Northwestern University Press now called The End of Chirac. And it's about about the etymology of the word a little bit and where specifically it comes from and why. But we're also kind of, you know, talking with people who, you know, live in the neighborhoods that Spike Lee is not even filming in, which is also a part of the problem of the film, is that a lot of the film is filmed on the north side of Chicago.
It's in Wicker Park,
right? And you know, that's not where, you know, the,
that's,
you know,
not
folks
Chirac.
That's not, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But so we're working on a book with Northwestern University and folks at Young Chicago Authors, and, you know, having, you know, our young people interview folks in the neighborhood, you know, folks from the neighborhood writing essays about the conditions of their community, and also imagining, you know, this future moment, unleashing our radical imagination on the notion of urban planning to try to imagine a city that is, you know, much more equitable and fresher for all people.
And, you know, one other thing about Chicago, obviously, as we're speaking, Nate, we were talking about this before, there's a lot going on just in terms of the police and the mayor and the Laquan McDonald case and all that kind of stuff. What is something that we should know, people who aren't from there should know about Chicago and the sort of politics and the police there to like help contextualize the story that's not getting into the headlines?
That's a really good question. I think like a few things. There's a few things that I think you should know, right? Number one, there's this idea that Chicagoans are, I mean, really black Chicago, because that's what we're talking about, right? That black Chicagoans are incensed by police violence and not by other kinds of violence, which is like patently false and just ridiculous. So, I mean, that's an important thing. And number two, like these are fights and conversations that we've been having for many, many years, right? Like I remember being in elementary school and like having a friend in my class whose dad like got picked up and held by the police for like 72 hours. And like, you know, like with that, with no charge, like, you know, like on some like black box shit. So like, these are not, these aren't new stories for us. They're not, and they're not really even like special stories. It's just like, oh yeah, this Thursday. Right. You know, one of our homies, Miguel Aguilar, was talking about like run-ins with the Vandal Squad, where he's a graffiti writer, where like in the 90s, like they would like beat the shit out of kids and take their cans and then and like paint the kids' whole bodies with the cans, right? So like, you know, CPD is
it's the city of John Birds, like, right. This is, you know, this is not new,
right? CPDK, you know, biggest, right. Gang, right?
CPDK. Middle fingers to the law. And if I got a...
CPDK is Chicago slang for Chicago Police Department killers. Generally, adding a K after a certain item in Chicago means that the item in question is an enemy. Although in this instance, CPDK could also be used to imply that the Chicago Police Department is a gang of killers. John Burge, as Kevin mentioned, was a Chicago police officer who was notorious for torturing over 200 criminal suspects between 1972 and 1991, all in order to get confessions. Burge was only truly brought to justice after the statute of limitations on most of his crimes had run out. He was eventually convicted on 2 counts of obstructing justice and 1 count of perjury. Spencer Ackerman, writing in The Guardian, reported settlements from lawsuits over Burge's use of torture and other expenses had cost the police department over $100 million.
I think what I would want people to know is that the movement, and even the reason why, you know, McCarthy fell on his sword and was asked to resign, and hopefully Anita Alvarez is next, and I think Rahm will probably go into an election cycle, but will hopefully lose. And I think the reason why there's so much pressure, the reason why there's so much media attention, is because young people of color, and I would say at the front of, and some of the main organizers in this moment, in this movement in Chicago, are young queer women of color. Yes. Who are leading this generation into a much better, fresher space. And there is a co-optation of the movement that is happening in Chicago right now. And the media, you know, is focusing on, you know, other older organizations run by, you know, like cis men, but it's really like this incredibly disciplined crew of women.
I mean, this is some radical black queer feminist shit.
Yeah, you know? Like, you know, and you know, and they have elders that are, you know, that they are mentored by, but, you know, I would, you know, BYP 100, Asada's Daughters,
yeah.
You know, We Charge Genocide. Like, these are the organizations, I think, to really keep up with in Chicago to understand what's happening there.
Yeah, I definitely remember hearing about We Charge Genocide very early on. And it's almost like the actual work that Spike Lee is pretending to talk about is actually being done by the people he's insulting in his movie.
Oh, that's absolutely happening. And that's nothing new. I think, you know, I think you would be hard pressed to have a, you know, if you take a womanist approach to looking at Spike Lee's films, it's hard to make a you know, critical. It's hard to not be critical of his portrayal of women historically. And so,
oh yeah,
in the film, when you see this kind of activism that is really only led by a white preacher, which is just really also, by the way, a white
Shouts
preacher,
to John Cusack,
a white preacher who in Chicago, by the way, came out in favor of Rahm Emanuel last election.
Father Michael Flager, the real life model for John Cusack's preacher character in Chirac, endorsed Rahm Emanuel in February 2015. His endorsement read in part, "Rahm believes every child in Chicago, no matter their circumstances or where they live, deserves a world-class education. Rahm has stood up for our neighbors and our children, and other city leaders are recognizing it." Obviously, this endorsement long predates the community's recent calls for Rahm Emanuel's resignation.
you know, it really is shitting on this history, this moment of organizing, hard-fought organizing, where, you know, young people of color are putting their bodies on the front lines of this movement and are not protected by the church and are not protected by the mayor. They are actually sought after and, you know, in the protests are targeted and arrested and brutalized and, you know, come back then the next day and do the same thing.
Right. And arrested and brutalized by both sides, right? By like other like quote unquote protesters that are interested in that kind of co-optation and this particular face of respectability, and also by you know, by the police, and that's the scary or the complicated thing about this moment of radical work is that it's not really safe on either side for those folks, right?
And, you know, one final thing, Nate, congratulations. As of literally yesterday, you were nominated for an NAACP Image Award for your book, Wild Hundreds.
My mom is super excited. It's great. She's like, yo, where are we going to L.A.?
How did you find out?
I found out on Twitter. Somebody, like, tweeted me. They were like, yo, Nate Marshall and all these other people are on this list. This list is dope. And I was like, what? I thought it was a joke. I thought it was wrong, but I've read it like three places, so I assume it's not a lie.
I feel like you should have got a call from like Sidney Poitier or something like that. You know what I'm
right?
saying? Like at least, you know, right. like yeah, like yeah, right. somebody
Anthony Anderson, someone.
Somebody. You know what I mean? Somebody. Somebody's like, excuse me, Mr. Marshall.
Right. I'ma just like go to the joint and I think Janet Jackson is nominated, so I'm gonna try and see what's up with her.
Hey, listen.
Hey.
Nice. All right. And so finally, what else? You know, obviously you're touring now to promote the Breakbeat Poet anthology. What else do you two have going on? Kevin, you mentioned a bunch of book projects.
Yeah. Stay writing these books. You know, we'll have this End of Chirac project out on Northwestern University Press, hopefully in the summer. Idris and I have a play that was produced at Steppenwolf last year that is also being published by Haymarket in the fall called This is Modern Art, about the night that a crew of graffiti artists bombed the modern wing of the Art Institute. And that play is being produced around the country right now, which is really exciting to see it get picked up from regional theaters. You know, I'm working on the next book of Chicago Poems myself. Nate and I are also talking about some future projects together. And, you know, we're trying to get Nate a full-time teaching job in Chicago, get that 10-year track money.
Let's do it. Yeah, I mean, this book, Wild Hundreds, so sort of pushing that. And then I'm also working on another book of poems called Finna. And yeah, man, trying to write these bars. I'm thinking about doing a new music project. I
would say you're a rapper too. You have an album. Yeah.
No college, but this drunken master scholars after dollars. My partner's never off and off the block studying bars. My other partners, they just want to be partners studying bars. But I study in bars. It's hard studying hard because bras be steady passing them notes, cutting draws. The crowd steady.
Yeah, so I released a record with my man's Just Love called Grown. Pretty recently. And yeah, so thinking about doing more music, been working with a couple folks in Chicago. And yeah, we'll see what happens.
All right. Well, thank you guys, Breakbeat Poets.
Thank
Kevin
you.
Povel, Nate Marshall, for coming through.
Thanks for having us, man.
I have to admit that going into reading the Breakbeat Poets anthology, I knew very little about poetry, aside from a small handful of personal favorites. But I love the book, and I think it does exactly what it sets out to do, transfers the feel and poetics of hip-hop onto the page. As a fan of so much of the rap that's coming out of Chicago right now, it was so interesting for me to hear about the beginnings of that scene, and the roles that Kevin and Nate played in it as mentors for so much of today's young talent. Join us next week when we talk to Rekia Mays about her career in radio, her new novel, The Man Curse, and a whole lot more. As I mentioned at the top, make sure you subscribe on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or a review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, you can make a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. You can find us everywhere on social media at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. More information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a whole lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
You know, it really is shitting on this history.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Dope, a dope theorist.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
He was like the squirrely little mixed kid on the soccer team.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Really? White people? Like, we're just going to do the same shit again and again forever?
Special thanks to Tony Medina and Aziza Barnes for reading their poems for us, and Idris Goodwin, who knows what he did.
I might actually not be smart enough to understand what they're doing.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Benjamin Bray.
I mean, this is some radical black queer feminist shit.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Here's a Tony Medina poem from the anthology The Breakbeat Poets, New American Poetry in the Age of Hip Hop, published by Haymarket Books, edited by Kevin Covell, Koresh Ali Lansana, and Nate Marshall. It is called Everything You Wanted to Know About Hip Hop, But Were Afraid to Be Hipped for Fear of Being Hopped. Asthmatics, don't try this at home. Hip-hop halitosis. Hip-hop, how you doing? Hip-hop hosiery. Hip-hop haberdashery. Hip-hop hollandaise sauce. Hip-hop allopent inhaler. Hip-hop hysterectomy. Hip-hop Viagra. Hip-hop Lamborghini. Hip-hop chancletas. Hip-hop unemployment. Hip-hop fortune cookie. Hip-hop auction block. Hip-hop umbrella, hip-hop rocking chair, hip-hop chandelier, hip-hop hula hoop, hip-hop hooray, hip-hop hurricane, hip-hop quagmire, hip-hop radial tire, hip-hop earth, wind, and fire, hip-hop muck and mire, hip-hop hot wire, hip-hop perspire, hip-hop fire and desire, hip-hop murder for hire, hip-hop liar, hip-hop sire, hip-hop retirement plan, hip-hop and the man, hip-hop Houlihan, hip-hop boogeyman, hip-hop sanitation truck, hip-hop don't gives a fuck, hip-hop can you spare a buck, hip-hop desperation, hip-hop inflation, hip-hop hives, hip-hop urtication, hip-hop meditation, hip-hop medication, hip-hop Tokyo Rose, hip-hop potato chips, hip-hop stovetop stuffing, hip-hop putrefaction, hip-hop Pepto-Bismol, hip-hop pundit, hip-hop fundit, hip-hop brothel, hip-hop silverware, hip-hop crystal stare, hip-hop buyer beware, hip-hop nuclear scare, hip-hop dental care, hip-hop Fred Astaire, hip-hop flare, hip-hop nightmare, hip-hop Tupperware, hip-hop hair, hip-hop stare, hip-hop chair, hip-hop bear, hip-hop share, hip-hop glare, hip-hop air, hip-hop wear, hip-hop heir to the throne, hip-hop dare, hip-hop holocaust, hip-hop hucklebuck, hip-hop helium, hip-hop delirium, hip-hop landing, hip-hop scanning, hip-hop canning, hip-hop fanning, hip-hop tanning salon, hip-hop rayon, hip-hop ding-dong, hip-hop donkey kong, hip-hop churning, hip-hop is burning, hip-hop earning, hip-hop learning, hip-hop discerning, hip-hop ham sandwich, hip-hop pork rinds, hip-hop spare ribs, hip-hop ham on rye, hip-hop lady die, hip-hop high five, hip-hop hard dive, hip-hop wanted dead or alive, hip-hop beehive, hip-hop jive, hip-hop sour cream and chives, hip-hop dives, hip-hop wives, hip-hop friendly skies, hip-hop handle, hip-hop scandal, hip-hop cross your heart bra, hip-hop crossword puzzle, hip-hop crossing, hip-hop bossing, hip-hop salad tossing, hip-hop dental floss, hip-hop hobby horse, hip-hop Mr. Ed, hip-hop Mr. Potato Head, hip-hop Freddy's dead, hip-hop pro-kids, hip-hop giving head, hip-hop led, hip-hop better dead than red, hip-hop shed, hip-hop dread, hip-hop sled, hip-hop feds, hip-hop raw shot test, hip-hop rutabaga, hip-hop scapula, hip-hop spatula, hip-hop ambiguity, hip-hop anxiety, hip-hop quadruped, hip-hop acumen, hip-hop chihuahua, hip-hop stockpile, hip-hop projectile, hip-hop cake with file, hip-hop goma pile, hip-hop dream weaver, hip-hop dumb beaver, hip-hop back alley, hip-hop rally, hip-hop white trash, hip-hop monster mash, hip-hop Moroccan hash, hip-hop pipes, hip-hop swipes, hip-hop baby wipes, hip-hop snipes, hip-hop gripes, hip-hop stereotypes, hip-hop Dukes of Hazzard, hip-hop oh dirty bastards, hip-hop hotel, hip-hop motel, hip-hop holiday inn, hip-hop constipation, hip-hop chia pet, hip-hop seeing eye dog, hip-hop Kermit the Frog, hip-hop closed captions, hip-hop subtitles, hip-hop country club, hip-hop city, hip-hop boo-boo kitty, hip-hop itty-bitty titty committee, hip-hop pity, hip-hop ditty, hip-hop epony, hip-hop economy, hip-hop sunlight, hip-hop ultra blight, hip-hop out of sight, hip-hop fly by night, hip-hop fly a kite, hip-hop despite, hip-hop draws, hip-hop hog maws, hip-hop tattoo paws, hip-hop broken jaws, hip-hop flaws, hip-hop crawls, hip-hop shaws, hip-hop snores, hip-hop bronchitis, hip-hop meningitis, hip-hop gold tooth, gingivitis, hip-hop grammar book, hip-hop graham crackers, hip-hop quarterback sackers, hip-hop weed whackers, hip-hop Dunkin' Donut snackers, hip-hop crumb snatchers, hip-hop booty smackers, hip-hop asthma attack, which is what I'm having, hip-hop comeback, hip-hop hooligan, hip-hop stool pigeon, hip-hop incision, hip-hop derision, hip-hop precision, hip-hop aneurysm, hip-hop Harvey Wallbanger, hip-hop no more wire hangers, hip-hop apologia, hip-hop mamma mia, hip-hop candy yams, hip-hop credit card scams, hip-hop Winnebago, hip-hop let my people go, hip-hop let go my ego, hip-hop shake and bake, hip-hop frosted flakes, hip-hop earthquakes, hip-hop on a plane with snakes, hip-hop, these are the breaks, hip-hop jewelry fakes, hip-hop wakes, hip-hop makes mistakes, hip-hop morphine drip, hip-hop liposuction, hip-hop facelift, hip-hop temper tantrum, hip-hop prenup, hip-hop D-up, hip-hop layup, hip-hop layoff, hip-hop pink slip, hip-hop sinking ship, hip-hop chocolate chip, hip-hop dip, hip-hop trip, hip-hop sip, hip-hop Similac, hip-hop stevedore, hip-hop I adore, hip-hop mi amor, hip-hop fundamentalist, hip-hop insanity, hip-hop payola, hip-hop Crayola, hip-hop Barbie, hip-hop stretch marks, hip-hop Robitussin, hip-hop epidemic, hip-hop epidural, hip-hop pandemic, hip-hop Pandora's box, hip-hop pancake mix, hip-hop panic button, hip-hop pedantic, hip-hop eye tick, hip-hop puritanical, hip-hop botanical, hip-hop purist, hip-hop fingerprints, hip-hop nation, hip-hop escalation, hip-hop exclamation mark, hip-hop after dark, hip-hop orthopedic shoes, hip-hop Hebrews, hip-hop EKG machine, hip-hop hydroplane, hip-hop crash test dummies, hip-hop down the drain.